Well, again, thanks for coming. And this is the folks here are still hanging on before the holidays. So
some of us.
Okay. So you know, it's a smaller group. We can have more of a discussion. I was just going to pick up sort of midstream of where it was. I want to review what we did last time, but this is one slide which I discussed last time. The expanding sections of Freeman Robinson Walker De Sitter, and show that there was particle creation in the Bunch-Davies state, and produces an energy density and a pressure, which is of order h to the fourth. So it's small if you have a weak expansion, but nevertheless, it shows that there is an effect, and that the Bunch-Davies state is really not the vacuum state. So I won't repeat all of this. I guess the thing I didn't have too much time to talk about last time was you can do the whole analysis again in the global sections. Again, it's more of a mathematical problem than of cosmological interest. But just because in relativity, people say, well, you know, you should use the manifold, which completely covers the space, and not slice it this way or that. So we also did the analysis a few years earlier, in fact, in the global case. And then you have to set up initial data on a section cutting through the hyperboloid at some early time and see what happens then. And notice now you have a contracting as well as an expanding phase. So it's a little bit different, but still qualitatively similar. So here are the wonderful formulas. It's again a scattering problem. If you decompose the mode functions, you decompose a scalar field in terms of harmonics on the three sphere, cutting through here, and time-dependent functions, I call the rescale time u in this case, and then the time-dependent mode functions satisfy an equation like this. And of course, over and over again, when you're dealing with De Sitter hyperboloids or spheres, over and over again, you get hypergeometric functions or Legendre functions, is just what corresponds to this group. So the Bunch-Davies state in this language corresponds to a particular solution of this equation, which is called positive frequency by people who set things up that way. And this is the one that's used, for example, typically in cosmology. So again, you can analyze this problem as a time-dependent harmonic oscillator if you rescale the mode functions by the scale factor to the 3/2. Then you get a very suggestive looking equation similar to the one we had in the flat sections, where it looks like a Schrodinger scattering problem in the time u with some potential that depends on the mode number k. And in fact, it's a negative, very smooth negative potential that just looks like this. So you again have incoming modes, which are partially reflected and partially transmitted. And in this language, this corresponds, if you do the setup in terms of a Fock basis, this corresponds again in the Schwinger or Stueckelberg or Feynman language, all equivalent, to a scattering problem in which you start out in the vacuum and you get particles created by this backscattering on this potential. Notice that the potential vanishes at early times and at late times, and therefore the solution of this equation is obviously just a pure exponential, and that's what you call positive frequency or negative frequency at late times or early times. And since you have a mixing between the early and late time mode functions, you again have particle creation.
Do you get a discrete spectrum for trapped modes?
Not if the mass is greater than, is larger than this value. But I'm taking here gamma to be real and positive.
So there's no
bound state. But indeed, if you would go to small masses, then you would have to worry about trapped states in here as well. It gets more complicated.
Or gravitons.
or gravitons, yeah, right? Yes, I mean, if you take the massless minimally coupled field, which is kind of a stand-in for gravitons, then gamma is imaginary, and then you have, then it's a different problem. Okay, but this was, again, just done in order to make things as conceptually clear as possible, not intended to be particularly realistic, but just to understand conceptually what's going on with particle creation. In this case, for massive field, where things are pretty clear, and on the global manifold. So I won't bother you with the formulas. Again, there are some kind of special functions involved, which behave, what's important is they behave as in solutions this way, as u goes to minus infinity, and out solutions that behave that way, which are the transmitted modes, as u goes to plus infinity. But you see these are not the same modes, so therefore there's a Bogle-Lyubov transformation between them. And the Bunch-Davy state, actually, you can do this Bogle-Lyubov transformation in two steps. One, write the in-state modes in terms of the Bunch-Davies modes, that's what this capital F is, and then write the out modes in terms of the Bunch-Davies mode. And basically, it's a composition of two Bogle-Lyubov transformations. So the Bunch-Davy state is in between, halfway in between. Not surprisingly, it's fully the sitter invariant, and therefore also time reversal invariant under the discrete symmetry. So you can look at what happens if you start in the in modes in vacuum. You can look at a time-dependent Bogle-Lyubov transformation, which basically interpolates between the in and the out states. And you again see these jumps. I think I showed this last week in the case of the expanding sections. In this case, you get two of them, because now there are two different times, one in the contracting phase with u less than zero, and symmetrically in the expanding phase with u greater than zero for each k. These colors are different k's. So the jump is the same in each case, but the time at which it happens is different for different k, because what's important is the physical momentum. Physical momentum is, of course, the co-moving momentum over the scale factor. So at a given physical momentum, you get a particle creation event, and that means the k at which that event, the k mode going through that event is different at different times. Okay, so it's, again, fairly straightforward. These are the magnitudes of the jumps, the first one, and then the total. And you see the different, there's a window in k modes for any given time. Now you can look at the energy momentum tensor in this case, and this is a bit, little bit different than in the expanding phase, because now what you find is that as you're in the contracting part of the sitter, these particles created get blue shifted now rather than red shifted. So that you're basically concentrating them as you contract.
This is for a single mode or?
This is the sum.
Sum over.
Here is a given mode. Each of these is a different mode. But this is now constructing the energy momentum tensor.
So what is the UV cutoff here?
You start with a vacuum. So you start with zero energy initially. That's your zero point. Then as these particles go through their creation, you count the energy of these modes.
Okay.
And so yeah, you can go through the details with this Bogle-Lyubov transformation. It's in those papers.
So your start time is the cutoff ratio.
Yeah. So you start. So now I want to start at a finite time, call it u naught, and go up to a finite late time, call it u. And then only a certain set of modes contribute because of this window. And you can see that if you start at an early time, this energy density scales like u naught, exponential in u naught, and 1 over a fourth. So here is an example. You start at u naught equals minus 5. That's 5 Hubble times basically before the neck of the sitter hyperboloid. And this set of modes contributes to the sum, and where k is given by this, and you see it grows during the this is rescaled a to the fourth times the renormalized energy momentum tensor, And so it goes like 1 over a to the 4th. It's growing exponentially in this time. So if I made this time earlier and earlier, then I would get a bigger and bigger energy density at the neck. And it's not hard to arrange things to have enough energy density to actually, here I'm not doing back reaction, but to calculate the energy density which would cause a significant back reaction. So in this setup in the full hyperboloid, you really see more clearly what's going on is that as the particles are created and they're blue shifted, then so you're being driven to the UV, then you get a bigger and bigger effect. But of course, it also involves an infrared cutoff because I had to start at a finite time. So there is a kind of interplay between the infrared and the ultraviolet. This is a conceptual issue just to do it in the full hyperboloid. It's not what we're really interested in cosmology, but it's illustrative, I think, of the effect that when you're pushed to the ultraviolet, you'll get a bigger and bigger effect. Whereas in the expanding phase, mode by mode, everything is being redshifted. Remember, I got just a constant effect there. So this actually gives you the hint of what you really should look for in order to see large effects. But I'll come to it in a second. And I think I showed this last time. If you think of the Bunch-Davies state in this language, it's a very peculiar situation in which you're not starting in the vacuum, as far as the Schwinger-Feynman prescription were telling you. You're starting in some populated state. And then mode by mode, these particles are destroyed, go to zero, and then are recreated. So in a sense, you've set things up in such a way that apparently nothing happens in the energy momentum tensor because mode by mode, the particles are being destroyed and created in such a way that when you sum them all up, you get a constant. So it's a kind of fine-tuned situation in which you have coherent annihilation and creation. In the electric field problem that we discussed last time, it corresponds to every time a particle pair is pumped out of the vacuum by the electric field, you range things to have a particle pair come in from infinity to annihilate at the same time so that there's no current. Okay? That, I think, is sort of intuitively a very fine-tuned situation. And when you do things with the...
What exactly are you plotting?
So these are, again, the particle numbers. Okay, so here I started in the vacuum state defined by the in vacuum. And you see there is nothing in each mode, but then I get a creation event. And so it goes in one direction, right? It's always increasing. Whereas if I plot the same thing for the Bunch-Davies state, I'm starting in a state which is not the vacuum, according to the I epsilon prescription. And so I start in a state which has particles in every given mode. But then the particle number goes to zero at some intermediate time, which corresponds to this event. But now it's sort of turned on its head, and the particles are destroyed this time. And then they stay destroyed until the symmetric time in the expanding phase when they're again created, and I go back to where I was. So this is why it looks like nothing's happening.
Sorry.
Yeah. Who's up?
So I'm listening.
Sorry.
Shall the state you're sitting here for the signal?
That's what I was saying here. So the initial state here is defined by the I epsilon prescription and the mass parameter, which means that at early times, the solution of this mode function for the positive frequency mode is a pure frequency e to the I gamma in this potential. Okay, that's not the Bunch-Davies state.
Do you have a solution on very large scale which can be this pure? Because you see that, on the other side, it's not oscillatory anymore, so it's just higher limit.
Well, it is. It, look at this potential. That's what this is.
With a large mass, it is, right?
Yeah, as long as the mass is greater, as long as this gamma factor is real, then it's always oscillatory. As someone asked before, in the low mass case, it's different because then I have to go tunneling through the barrier. Okay? So There was another question?
Yeah. When you say about fine tuning, can you evaluate how much fine tuning there is? Does it take a point per unit perturbation of Davis?
That's where I'm going. Exactly where I'm going. Okay, very good. I didn't plant you, right? No, you're anticipating what I'm doing. So, so this, I think, illustrates, for example, what Polyakov is saying verbally. I didn't understand his language, but I think that's what he's trying to say when he talks about, I shouldn't put words in his mouth, but I think he would agree with this, that the Bunch-Davies state is kind of on life support. You've arranged things in such a way so that it apparently nothing happens, and that looks like the natural thing to do for symmetry, but it's not the natural thing to do. It's not the right thing to do, I would say, if you define particle modes by the Schwinger or Feynman prescription. It's not the ground state. People use the word vacuum, but it's not really a vacuum state in any sense. Okay, so
I have a question about the previous slide.
And I'm gonna ask about perturbing this.
Okay.
Yeah.
The previous slide you mentioned UVIR. Can you?
Well, okay. It's an offhand remark. It's just saying that I have to have a cutoff, an IR cutoff in time. But when the particles are created, they're driven by the contraction or expansion to very different frequencies.
So you have a connection.
You have a connection. I mean, as any gravitational problem, in particular with a horizon, you always have this big blue shift, red shift factor between one place and another. So here you just see how this works. Okay. So this is basically just to summarize. The last time, I won't go over it again, I did talk about the expanding sections, and then you do start in the Bunch-Davies state, and that also produces particle creation. The thing we found there is that we could even turn the sitter on and off so that we could verify that the particles are real, but then it's sensitive to how you turn things off. So at the expanding, in the contracting phase, things are blue shifted and you see ultraviolet stuff. But in the expanding phase, things are red shifted, so you see infrared stuff. Okay? But the sitter manifold is, after all, homogeneous. So you should be able to describe it in both things are happening at the same time. So the main conclusion from this is that you had better think about back reaction. And we would love to do massless fields, gravitons as well, but let's stick with the massive case for a little bit more. I would say that these, sort of test or toy problems show that there is a quantum mechanism for reducing lambda. There is a decay rate, however you calculate it, which is analogous to the electric field case. And so then the question you want to ask is, okay, you've got this effect, but how do you see what happens, and what's the relevant effect of field theory to describe this? So, if you've heard my other talks, you won't be surprised that I'm going to argue that the relevant effect of theory is the one in semi-classical physics comes from the conformal anomaly. So, this is a slide from one of the previous talks, is that in a sense, a general relativity is an effect of field theory for low-energy physics, but there are quantum corrections. And you should ask yourself, in some regime where you're far from the Planck scale, but larger than any other mass scale in the problem, what is the relevant effect of the trace of the energy momentum tensor back on the metric? And for a number of years, I've been trying to argue and testing this in various ways that the relevant term is the one that comes from the one-loop effect of action that you can calculate from the trace anomaly. So the trace anomaly in a curved background looks like this. It's the Weyl tensor squared. This is the Euler-Gaspinet invariant. This is just box R. And as I argued in other talks, this leads to massless poles and new relevant operators in even a Wilsonian-like description of effective theory, which can have macroscopic effects. So let's apply this now to cosmology.
Can you connect it to Fred? That is
the particle creation. Or?
Yeah. Before you were talking about particle creation, now you're.
Yeah, I'm jumping. I'm switching.
Is there is there a way to continue the thread of the particle creation?
Okay.
The anomalies are, if I can.
Yeah, I mean, I can calculate the stress tensor in two different ways. One from the underlying field theory with these Bogoliubov transformations. The other way from the anomaly stress tensor and compare them. And if I have the similar initial conditions, I get similar results. So that's one way to compare them. But this is a more robust, I would say, way of thinking about it. Because I don't know, if you think about this, you say, okay, I have some particle creation effect. It looks like my vacuum energy can change, but I have to identify the degrees of freedom which are allowing that to happen. And that's why I'm shifting gears
this is
to this.
Postulating, but is there a way to reveal them?
Well, in some cases, case by case, but there are still questions. So let's talk.
Is the related to that? So the particle creation case we were focusing on usually was the mass above a certain critical threshold.
Good.
Would this be describing that, or would it be describing the mass, the creation of masses?
Very good. So in the thing I'm going about to describe, you can show, actually prove, that for conformally coupled fields in a conformally flat space, it's exact, at least to linear order. Okay. So the answer is it would describe conformally flat, conformally coupled fields exactly. But of course, it doesn't describe all cases exactly because there are lots of other terms in the effect of action. But I still think it's arguably the most important one because of this massless degree of freedom that exists here and not in any of the other terms. But the answer to the precise answer to your question is for conformally coupled fields, it's actually an exact statement. Conformally coupled means that there is no other trace. There's no mass term. It's all coming from the anomaly. That's why you have control of it. So these are the formulas. The anomalous effect of action can be written in a non-local form in terms of these coefficients. Now, this is Duff's notation, B prime, which predates everyone. But now I think everyone calls this the A coefficient for some reason. So it's the same thing. It's the Euler-Gauss-Bonnet. It's given in terms of the number of scalars, fermions, and vectors. These are conformally coupled fields. And as we introduced a few years ago, you can write this in terms of a scalar, which I call a conformalon, just because I don't want to use the word dilaton that confuses with other things. And then you can write this in a local form. And this is some fourth order derivative term. So you can write in a non-local form in which there is no apparent higher derivative term, but it's a propagator, which is long range, or you can write in a local form where you have this fourth order kinetic term, and I'll show you how to deal with this. So this modifies general relativity in infrared because you have some kind of new massless field in the game or a propagating mode, which in the previous talks I've argued can be understood as a collective or coherent state of the underlying field theory that gives rise to the anomaly. The main result is that this couples to the conformal factor of the metric, which now becomes dynamical rather than frozen as it is in Einstein's theory.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
My confusion is if I just establish a conformally coupled scalar field,
yes,
then supposedly I do get the conformal anomaly.
Yes.
But then you're replacing that, you go through this and then come back and then you replace that conformally coupled scalar field with this conformalon.
Yes.
And so, but I know originally that that was the correct action, that was the conformally coupled scalar that I started from. Mm-hmm. So
you could do it, that's I think similar to his point. You could do everything with the field theory.
Yeah.
Okay. But this is an effect integrating out the quantum fields.
But then you integrate them back in.
Well,
Phi,
I don't integrate them back. I mean, this is the exact effect of action for a conformal field. So you have some set of matter fields, right, in the path integral. And you have some minimally coupled action, right, matter and gravity.
Right.
Okay. And now I integrate out the matter fields, and this depends also on the metric, and I get an effective action, a Wilson, not Wilsonian, but one loop exact effective action in terms of the metric. So this is this effective action, which you know, you can look at it as a matter of convenience to write it in the local form. It's just a rewriting. Or you can look at it, and I think I would like to argue that that's really a better way to look at it as a new local degree of freedom, which is some collective mode of the underlying theory.
Right, right. But if I underline the theory by just a single formally coupled scalar field, then
or any number of conformally coupled fields.
It's much more general than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, because they're all coupled the same way to gravity.
Right, but if it's just the simplest case, which is just a single conformally coupled scalar field,
yeah,
then you somehow replace one with basically an ordinary scalar field with one with these extra derivatives in it. I just understand, are you increasing the number of degrees of freedom there?
No, it's a good question. No, I mean, if you could keep track of all the measure factors and everything in this path integral, then you, in a sense, just change variables. You can't have made more or less than was already there.
Yeah.
Okay, and in two dimensions, you can actually follow that in detail and show exactly
that. In two dimensions, because that's delta 2, then it's the same thing. But in four dimensions, it's not.
No, but okay, you can actually count the determinants and show that it's the same thing. Here, of course, now you've got to keep track of the whole measure, and it's a little bit trickier. But I don't think there's anything new. If you come from the fundamental theory, I don't think there's anything that you've added to it.
I guess what I'm
it's a repackaging.
Better additional constraints.
Yeah. Well, a diffeomorphism. Yeah.
You're saying that even if it's a fourth order term, the initial data is only finite.
No, I'm not. I didn't say that.
Okay.
There is intrinsically additional degrees of freedom here, but if I were to write this down as it is and nothing else, then you would have a scalar field with a fourth order Lagrangian, and you would have these extra degrees of freedom.
Yes.
End of story.
Yes.
But I'm putting this into the theory with gravity, and so this is it's coupled to the metric. And I'm going to impose the diffeomorphism constraints. That's where the constraints come from. They come from diffeomorphisms of the gravitational theory. It's not just any old scalar. It's a scalar that's coupled to gravity in a very special way. Okay. And when I impose that, you're anticipating what I want to show you. Yeah. But let me get there. And this is the end of the talk. So yeah. I want to get to that. Okay, so this is what that operator looks like. In De Sitter space, it has a lot of neat properties because, of course, it comes from a conformal, its properties are associated with conformal invariants. So in fact, it factorizes, and this is one way it factorizes, in terms of a massless minimally coupled scalar and a massless conformally coupled scalar. And in the Gauss-Bonnet, it has a source, right? Because the Gauss-Bonnet invariant in De Sitter space is not zero. The Weyl tensor is zero. It's conformally flat. But the this combination of curvatures is not zero in De Sitter space. So it's sourced by this term in De Sitter space. And that means any solution of this equation has to break De Sitter invariants. Indeed, another way to look at things is if you factorize the propagator, it's a difference of two massless fields, again, minimally coupled and conformally coupled. And as is known for a long time, this operator doesn't have an inverse, doesn't have a De Sitter invariant inverse. And so again, there's a sensitivity to infrared physics. In fact, this propagator is a logarithm. So that shows you why there's some infrared phenomena going on. This is related partially to your question. If you actually just do the simplest possible thing and take in the De Sitter hyperboloid, you can easily solve this equation for any function which is just a function of the time, u. You find four homogeneous terms, and this is the inhomogeneous term that you need to satisfy this source. And then you construct the stress tensor. I wrote it down in one of the previous talks. It's, you know, fills on one slide, but you can just write it down and evaluate it for this solution. And what you find, first of all, is from the inhomogeneous term, you find exactly the Bunch-Davies energy momentum tensor. So if nothing else, this is a pretty efficient way of calculating, because I don't have to do any quantum field theory now. It's already done for me. I have an effective action. And for field of any spin, I just calculate B prime. And then it appears here in the energy density. And bang, in one shot, I get the energy density of the Bunch-Davies state for any spin. And it's just given, it just depends on this coefficient. And then if you add these other terms, here's the 1 over a fourth. So there you can compare in a simple way this 1 over a fourth I showed in the contracting phase or expanding phase. You can see it corresponds to these state perturbations of the Bunch-Davies state. So adding homogeneous solutions to this inhomogeneous equation corresponds to perturbing the state of the underlying theory, and therefore changes the energy momentum tensor and gives you this 1 over a fourth relativistic term. So before, you know, I won't go back there, but before we saw the particles get created and get blue shifted, and depending on initial conditions, be approximately 1 over a to the fourth, and now you see you can just get that very quickly just by evaluating the classical stress tensor coming from this quantum effective action. Okay. So next thing I wanted to do is to perturb things. Okay. So this was a very simple time space independent perturbation. But I want to do things consistently to linear order as people discuss linear response in condensed matter physics. You have some solution, in this case Bunch-Davies, which is a consistent solution of the semi-classical equations, and I'm going to replace the stress tensor by the anomaly stress tensor. If I evaluate it in this with this Bunch-Davies solution, the one that gives me the Bunch-Davies energy momentum tensor, then of course I get a self-consistent de Sitter solution. On this side, TAB is proportional to GAB. And on here's the GAB. On the other side, it's also proportional to GAB and de Sitter. So in the expanding coordinates, the Bunch-Davies solution can be written as just twice the logarithm of the scale factor, and this then also gives you the Bunch-Davies answer. So basically, you're looking at a self-consistent background in which you have a small correction of order h to the fourth to the cosmological term. Otherwise, it's all de Sitter. So since I have a consistent background, I can expand around it. So I take the linear perturbations around this background, and I have a perturbation of the metric together with a perturbation of this field. I mean, I could do this probably, I'm pretty sure, in the original theory, but it would be much harder and more difficult. But if I do it in this effective theory, then I have only classical equations to solve. And here's where the constraints come in. So I'm supposed, this is now a theory of gravity, right? So I'm supposed to solve the linearized Einstein constraints, which are the time-time and time-space components. And they look like this. It turns out the variation of the scalar r is 0. The variation of the time-time and time-space components can all be written in terms of one thing called V or epsilon, which is some particular combination, second order equation on the perturbation phi. And this thing satisfies a second order equation. Because, of course, if I operate with this on this, I get a fourth order equation. I get back my fourth order equation. But the other modes, the modes for which this operator annihilates phi, don't appear in linear response. Okay, so to linear order, this is what happened also in
V is
this thing. V is a gauge invariant piece of the conformal on perturbation.
So phi is standard phi.
this is, well, yeah, I mean, it turns out you have to use gauge invariant variables. Sorry, that's why I have a different symbol. But yes, it's essentially delta phi in some gate. Yeah, in some gate. And so we did it once in one gauge, and then we realized we could write in a gauge invariant way. So in a gauge invariant language, you first have to find the solutions of this equation, which are non-zero. So of course, half the solutions that you find for the delta 4 operator are annihilated by the second order term. And the other things are not annihilated satisfy a second order wave equation. And those are the ones that enter the Einstein equations. So this is exactly what this is parallel to what we found in flat space. You can actually just take the h equals 0 limit, and you see it's essentially the same thing as the flat space case, in where we had a second order equation for these scalar gravitational waves. That's what you can think of this as, scalar gravitational waves satisfying a second order equation and coupling to the metric and satisfying the Einstein constraints this way. Okay? So that's how the.
Your physical modes are only the V.
The physical modes are only the V, at least in linear order. Okay?
So these are like the Newtonian modes, right? If I use the soft language. Is that related to some kind of conservation equations for the Newtonian modes?
Why do you call them Newtonian? Nothing is non-relativist.
Yeah, but when you look at infrared physics, there is Goldstone modes that appear. These Goldstone modes add the interpretation of the Newtonian potential, and they have a non-trivial.
So these will couple to the potentials,
okay.
But there are two potentials, it's not just a Newtonian one.
Well, if you look at the RTT, which couples to the energy, it's box of V. So V is.
This is spatial,
yes,
grad squared.
That's exactly the potential. If you source it by TTT, by the energy. I mean, there's a lot of relativistic version.
In the next slide or two, I'm going to show you what the potentials are. But there are two potentials. It's not just. All I'm saying is it's not just pure Newtonian. Of course, it has a Newtonian limit, right?
Yeah. So right.
Okay. Relativistic version.
More degrees of freedom, and I guess the question is, I mean, you should have twice the degrees of freedom of GR, twice the degrees of freedom of, say, single scalar field.
That's right, but half of them are decoupled. That's the point.
Phi is decoupled from.
The phis that
lead to a zero V are decoupled.
Okay.
So there's also some cute mathematics here.
At
the linear level.
Okay. So linear about
Right. So there's another cute thing here, of course. I showed you a factorization of that delta 4 operator in terms of box and box minus 2 H squared. This times this is also a factorization. And this happens in any conformally flat space time, because this is a very special operator. So it has lots of neat properties. So it took some time to realize that this factorization happens, and that in fact only half of the solutions couple. Okay. So this is easy to solve, notice it doesn't have the same form. These modes have interpretation of certain conformal weights in terms of scalars, but they're not. It's not a covariant equation. This cannot be written in terms of just a box, which would have a 3H. Okay, so this is still nevertheless easy to solve in the expanding coordinates, and so you just write in Fourier space. I'm in flat.
Was that a
reason to flat? Let's all have a discussion.
No, I'm just wondering why you went back to flat this.
Simpler. This analysis is simpler. Otherwise, I have to deal with those hyperbolic functions and all that stuff. But it should work the same way. It's conceptually, it's the same. Yeah. In fact, use it as kind of crutch, because once you find the solutions in these coordinates, you can then transform them anywhere you want. But this is all gauge invariant in the end. Did you want to say something else?
After,
okay, good. All right. So I've made that point. So you can solve this equation without too much difficulty. And it has an extra 1 over a in it compared to a scalar field. So if you had a conformally coupled scalar that corresponds to 2h squared, I don't want to call it phi, let's call it capital phi, then this is solved by 1 over a squared, 1 over a, e to the I k dot x, times the conformal time, basically, which in this language is 1 over a. So, so this is what a scalar would look like, but you have an additional 1 over a squared, additional 1 over a. So if you do the traditional decomposition a la Bardeen or Stewart into scalar sector, this of course is only going to couple to the scalar metric perturbations. So the transverse traceless modes just go on their merry way. They're unaffected by this. And so they're still usual gravitons at linear order. They're not coupled together yet. And now I decompose the scalar metric perturbations. And you can define these gauge invariant variables. Again, I didn't want to confuse with phi, so I used this symbol epsilon. And there are two of them. So one combination is the Newtonian one, but I have two of them in the general setup. And without going through all the details, here's what the solution is. The sum of the two is just directly proportional to V. And so I'm just going to plug it into these constraints and solve for the potentials. I get some differential equations here on the left side, differential operator. And I just have to solve it in terms of V. You can do that. And basically, this is what the solution looks like. So the sum of potentials is directly proportional to this V, which you can solve. And the difference of potentials is sourced by a different combination of V, which is also trivial to solve in the FRW coordinates. Okay, that's the result of solving the linear equations. And again, you see the same feature we were discussing before, namely in the expanding coordinates, A is expanding, so a, 1 over A is decreasing, so this just drops off. So you might say, again, everything's redshifting. I don't see anything particularly interesting here. But remember, the sitter is a homogeneous manifold, and where there is redshifting, there's also blue shifting. So you have to look at the right thing in order to see a larger effect. So what we did, actually, was to first solve it in these Robinson-Walker coordinates, where things are pretty simple. And then later on, and actually I've done some of this while I've been here, and haven't written it all up yet, you can transform all of this to the static coordinates of the sitter space. So remember the conformal diagram, the hyperboloid is mapped to this square, where I suppress the angular variables. The slices through here are S3. But if I look at only the Robinson-Walker coordinates, I'm looking at one wedge, say the upper half wedge. If I look at the static coordinates, then I'm only covering this one quarter wedge here, or there's a duplicate region on the other side. And so I have a past horizon and a future horizon where this metric function goes to zero. So the decay that I see of these modes as A goes to infinity also corresponds, of course, to a singularity as A goes to zero. So on the past horizon, I have these scalar waves diverging. So in a sense, this corresponds to putting a source of these waves in the infinite past in the Bunch-Davies state. So it's a big effect in the infinite past because A is going to zero. But I'm interested also in looking at the future horizon. So if there are solutions here, there must be solutions there. That's obvious by time reversal symmetry. You just don't easily see them in the other coordinates. So you have to do a little work to transform this these equations to the static coordinates. I've done that work. I'll skip through all the details. But here is what the V modes look like. Now I decompose in time and angular momenta, right? Because in these coordinates, in these coordinates, the natural thing to do is decompose in static time, e to the minus I omega t, times an angular part, which is a YLM, and then a radial function. And so the only hard part is to find the radial function. And again, you find your favorite Legendre functions. The details don't matter. The important thing is that indeed, now I have two kinds of solutions, one of which diverge in the past horizon, as I found before, and another half which diverge on the future horizon. So you can find them both. Okay? And of course, you could transform this back to the other coordinates, but it would be, you know, be a mess of these transformation of these special functions. I should probably do write that up in some clear form. So
are you saying all solutions do this? Either the past or the future horizon?
Yep. You're stuck. Either the solution is zero, or it diverges on one horizon or the other. That's what you get. Or it also can diverge in the interior, but I've excised those. Okay? I can also put sources in the interior of the wedge, and then I would have some, you know, Coulomb-like singularity there. But I excluded those.
So I thought you couldn't have zero.
Zero and what?
Zero. If V was zero, isn't that inconsistent?
No. I mean, to linear order, I always have a trivial solution, right? I can always put this to zero and this to zero. Zero equals zero.
You had the perturbator.
Yeah, but I'm.
The background cannot be zero.
Right.
You perturb the background.
I'm perturbing both the fields in the background consistently to linear order. No, by the way, this is, I mean, it's obvious, I guess, but maybe not to every single person in the room, that this is obviously much more than perturbation theory, right? I'm not just perturbing one mode or looking at a fixed background. I'm letting everything linearly change together, okay? And it turns out you can do that. So of course, there's always a trivial solution, zero, but because these are homogeneous equations. But you exactly got the point, Ayesh, that any non-trivial solution always has this property. There's no solution finite on both the future and past horizon. No non-trivial solution. And you can then work out, again, the potentials in these static coordinates. So again, that is the main punchline, actually, that you have a second order equation. The equation can be solved. And the solutions always diverge on one horizon or the other. You can also look at static solutions. You can ask yourself, maybe that's where we should step back. I'm almost done. What does this mean? Well, you have to work a little bit to transform this back to the original field theory. But again, these are some kind of coherent modes which perturb the stress tensor in a time harmonic way and correspond to some kind of flux. So if you calculate the stress tensor corresponding to this, basically, you're looking at a flux which is going in or out of the static region. And that's intuitively similar to what you would think of a particle creation effect. If you're creating particles, then there's some flux of particles that are flowing in or out of the horizon. And this is basically, without using the word particles or without using all that machinery of Bogoliubov transformation, just solving the equations, you get these behaviors on the horizon.
Global foliation, because that's regular, that covers everywhere, so wow.
Yeah, so you can play with all the foliations you want. So this is what it looks like in the flat section.
Yeah.
So you can well imagine, I haven't written it down, but it's not, I can easily do it.
But the thing is, basically.
These are not the coordinate singularity. These are, you know, these are gauge invariant perturbations. Okay. So let me try to answer your first question. So in the hyperbolic, full hyperbolic coordinates, you must expect the solutions are going to behave this way, as a goes.
A doesn't go to zero,
but it can go to a minimum. And you can get an energy density which is large. All of these things are equivalent. The point is, you have linear equations. you can separate the equation. You know, it's like Laplace's equation. You can separate it in Cartesian coordinates, or you can separate it in spherical coordinates and cylindrical coordinates, any way you like. But of course, the solutions can be transformed. Any solution it may be inconvenient in one coordinate, but any solution you find in one coordinate can be transformed to the other.
The fact that a gauge of varying potential divergence does not mean there's a real divergence.
Exactly.
I mean, Newtonian gauge fails in a number of situations. The gauge of varying potentials are exactly the Newtonian gauge potentials. So
well,
in your case, it's a bit more general, but I think you still have to show that the geometry is singular. That's a separate question.
Well, the stress tensor corresponding to this divergence.
That's not a gauge of varying
quantity. Yes, it is. The
if it's only gauge of varying linear order, then it's not gauge of varying. So no, you have to demonstrate there's a real singularity.
Well,
that is a separate question.
Well, let's discuss it. But if you calculate the stress tensor with one up, one down, in particular, the diagonal part of this thing is gauge invariant. It's gauge invariant at linear order.
And you take that quantity diverges.
Yeah, it goes like this.
Okay, have to think about it. Yeah. There are many situations where potentials diverge, but that is not a real singularity.
I think all that means is that perturbation theory in that gauge breaks down
This is not a gauge-dependent statement. It means the perturbations become large, and yes, linear theory breaks down, and you have to do back reaction.
So if you could find a gauge where that was not true, it would just be a better gauge.
But there is no such gauge.
Well,
there is no such gauge.
You have to explore all gauges.
Well, okay, but that's the value of a gauge invariant thing. But you're going to explore.
Gauge invariant is a misleading word in this context. These are really gauge fixed.
Wait. There are two. So, all right, we have to have a discussion, clearly.
Sure.
But there are two different things. One is what that we're discussing here. One is background coordinates.
Right. That's right.
And the other is linearized perturbations. And gauge transformations of the perturbation. Those are two different things. Okay. So in any and I answered two different questions. In any given coordinates, you can solve the equations for gauge invariant quantities in those coordinates, and find these behaviors. Okay. And any solution I find in one coordinate chart, I can always transform to another coordinate chart, and nothing is going to change.
Unless you have a singularity involved.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have to go all the way to the singularity. The important point is, if I get close to this point, things are becoming unbounded. So as soon as they're unbounded, the conclusion you already drew is right. Namely, I have to do back reaction. Linear perturbation theory is breaking down. That's
not necessarily. You may find a gauge which doesn't break down.
I don't think so, but let's.
I know of examples where.
But you have to apply it to this.
No gauge is good in all circumstances.
But this is a gauge invariant.
This is gauge fixed. It's not gauge invariant. That's misleading terminology.
I don't agree, Neil, on this. But let's. But we need to discuss.
This is a widespread misunderstanding. Dean, who wrote the article, gauge.
No, I think there are more than one way of saying the same thing, and they sound different. But that's why you write equations, because we all agree on the equations. Okay, so I'm not just using words.
You're just posing a challenge. Can you find another gauge in which I don't have?
I just want to.
I don't think you've shown that.
We obviously have to talk, but I just want to clarify that we're talking about the same thing.
Sure.
Okay. So when you say find another gauge, are you talking about changing the linear perturbations and keeping the background coordinates fixed, or are you talking about changing the background coordinate chart? By that?
Keep the same background coordinates.
Okay, so that's a separate question.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Is there a point there, Neil, you're saying that
the gauge invariant quantities that Amiel has chosen don't necessarily correspond to physically observable.
Well, that's certainly true.
No, but you can calculate the stress term.
Diverge, but have no actual consequence.
Exactly.
And you were saying if that were the case,
right,
you could then find another gauge for potentially divergence.
No, but that hypothesis is simply incorrect here. It's not what happens, because you can plug this all back in any way you want. This, if this diverges, these components of this of the curvature diverge.
Yeah, but they're components, right?
They're components.
You need to show that something truly.
Look, you can now calculate, you can now contract this thing with various things if you want, and it still diverges. So there are.
Maybe.
But so I think the examples you're thinking about, I don't know what's in your head, Neil. But they're not.
I can point to examples of what you're saying in other contexts. Where one can't find.
Okay.
For gauge variables, fine.
Okay, some interpretation of what I'm saying. But okay, but all right. But and that you can also calculate the stress tests. Mm-hmm. And you can look at the back reaction on the geometry, and it is truly large there. But all right, let's leave it at that.
Just yeah. For reference, yeah. But I was saying that there could be a different coordinate charge reference.
Okay, you were trying to, you're having a different question. So there I would say keep the same solutions. Don't fool around the gauge of those at the same time. But then do any coordinate change you want in the background, and you can also transform those solutions to any background you want. And they still diverge at the same place geometrically.
Well, I mean,
they may be harder to describe.
I mean, I've yet to see the one in the global foliation. I guess that's harder, but you haven't.
Well, Nayesh, what all you have to do is a little exercise. All you have to do is take these solutions and transform them, and you'll get some, you know, some lovely integral representation of these Legendre linear order.
No, but now that doesn't work because they're different parts of the space that you cannot just map onto the other.
In the place where they cover this in their common ground.
The trouble with these coordinates is you found the divergence where the coordinates break out.
That's right. Yeah.
No.
I mean that's just the same statement again. That you know here, this diverges as a equals zero. But that's
slicing, but you know it doesn't. Nothing diverges in the closed slice.
They do. If I transform this to the curved slices on the, if I take this solution, which is complicated in the other coordinates.
Sure.
Then it will diverge at the same place geometrically.
If you regard it as a scale.
If what do you mean? As it is.
If you're regarding B as a scale.
I'm just but taking this formula, whatever it is.
B,
I'm just rewriting.
Choice of gauge. So.
Okay. I think so. So I think there are common misconceptions here, and we need to sort them all out. But if I have a function. Okay, I don't say whether it's scalar, anything. It's a function in some coordinates, in some chart, x, y, z. Okay, and I give you a coordinate transformation. I can plug these in here and calculate the same function in the other coordinates, and it will diverge at the same place. I make no statement that is a transformation of gauge.
I think it's much harder than that because this is just one mode, and you wanna sum all of them.
No, no.
The mode in one chart is not the same as the mode in another chart.
No, that's right. This mode, in this single Fourier mode in one chart,
yeah,
is going to be a superposition
exactly
of modes in the other chart.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why you're going to get an integral
that's
over those modes.
Even though a single one-way diverge, if you add all of them up, that doesn't have to diverge because they're equivalent cancellations.
No. You can always look at one perturbation. What happened? You can always look at a perturbation in a given mode in any particular coordinates. I can always look there. It's a linear equation. I can choose a solution. There are all kinds of solutions. I can write a superposition, but I can pick one.
Your conclusion is very strong that there is no solution except B equals zero. Your conclusion is that there is no solution except B equals zero. That was your conclusion of this analysis. There's no solution in these. That, well, your Actually, you're just saying there's no solution stopped on global the sitter except V equals zero. That's your claim. And we're just trying to...
Okay. So maybe, you know, maybe I said something that I can be more careful with.
There's no solution.
Right. Okay, I'll qualify this one. There's no solution of these equations, this chart, which is finite on both the future and past horizon.
Right. So then that, the natural question is there any solution that's finite on global in any chart and in any gauge?
All right. Fair enough. I'm telling you what I did. Fair enough.
Fair enough. It seems to me like something more needs to be done.
Okay, but let's try to define what that is. I mean, I've looked at this in many different ways,
yeah.
And each one is a little bit different, and you know, you're involved with these functions. So that's great. Let's define what you think should still be done. So I'm already out of time. What the last thing I was going to talk about is that if you look at the static modes and you have this logarithmic behavior, then you can also think about fluctuations in these modes and classify them according to their conformal weights on the horizon. Indeed, as I think I've discussed in a previous talk, if you scale out the metric factor here, then you can look at the optical metric, the so-called resulting metric, on the t equal constant slices in the Poincaré-like coordinates, and this is just the Lobachevsky manifold. In other words, you get conformal invariance or Euclidean anti-de Sitter space, and you expect conformal behavior. So, you know, this can all be classified in a more general way, and indeed, in terms of the symmetries, the killing vectors of the de Sitter space can be decomposed into conformal vectors. So we'll have to find you later. Can be classified in conformal, their conformal transformations on the sphere. So there's a conformal subgroup of the de Sitter group of null rays, and therefore you shouldn't be surprised, just on general grounds, that as you approach the horizon, that you have conformal behavior. And indeed, this operator delta 4 has a logarithm in terms of the angular variables directions n dot n prime on the horizon. And that basically corresponds to a conformal weight zero field. So you can classify these by the language of conformal field theory and look at how things scale as they behave near the horizon in terms of the distance. And W equals zero is the logarithmic behavior. And this is exactly what corresponds to a propagator in spherical harmonics, which is 1 over L plus 1, if I take out the zero mode. And in other words, that is the same behavior as you expect for Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum. So this is a speculation. Clearly, one needs a full model. But I just simply notice that the conformal weight that I get from these fluctuations from this horizon modes of the anomaly actually give me weight zero scale invariant spectrum on the horizon, and which is the right spectrum for the larger scale angular fluctuations. So there's at least a possibility, more to be done here, but at least a possibility that the anisotropy can come from these modes rather than an inflaton. I now have a scalar mode, which is given to me by the anomaly. I don't have to put it in terms of an inflaton. It's clearly not an inflaton. It doesn't have a potential and slow roll and all that story. But there is some effect on fluctuations of the metric in the scalar sector. And these could actually, in some...
Sorry, didn't it have a potential? Wasn't there a phi square term in the...
No. As a kinetic term, and then there's a linear coupling to the metric, to the conformal anomaly terms of the metric.
So it's
a free theory, without.
There's no quadratic.
No. Okay. Yeah. All the complications come from the Einstein-Hilbert term, not from the anomaly.
Okay.
except for the delta 4. So what we also did in one paper a few years ago is we looked at the conformal Ward identities in various ways. For the three-point function, as you probably know, conformal CFT, conformal invariance, fixes the form of the three-point function. And so as a function of the weight, you get this behavior. And as you take W to 0 for conformal invariant weight 0 field on the horizon, you get this kind of sum of logs, which is completely separable and a quite different shape function than you get from slow roll inflation. So it's not well parameterized by the current FNL bounds. So I've been trying to think about trying to look at the Planck data and asking whether or not if you assume some three-point bispectrum like this, what sort of bound can you put on the amplitude of the coefficient? But I need someone who actually understands how to do the templates for Planck and extract information given some formula for the three-point function. Of course, this is also quite a dramatically different, not only a dramatically different spectrum, but a different picture completely because it's non-spatially homogeneous or isotropic in that I've selected some particular de Sitter horizon out of all the possible ones. And so one, of course, is not going to sit right in the center of this. And you have to consider the distortions also from the fact that you're not in the center. So if you're some two-thirds of the way off, how are you going to see this spectrum? And by the way, that could be an interesting possibility for looking at the anomalies in the low L multiple moments, because that would affect most of the low multiple moments. We also pointed out that since the metric conformal invariance will also fix the form of the Gaussian two-point function of the perturbations of the graviton. And since it all comes from the same metric perturbation, you basically have to have a relation between the tensor index and the scalar index. So if ever we measure primordial gravitational spectrum of gravitational waves, finding out what its spectral index is and how it's related or unrelated to the scalar one will also tell us something very important about the origin of the fluctuations and whether this is on the right track or not. Last thing is, I'll stop because I'm out of time, but this also suggests using the conformal anomaly as a theory of dynamical vacuum energy, and I have some ideas on how to do that, but I think I should leave it for here because that's more speculative, and we can talk about it after. So I'm going to stop. I just put up my last slide, and thank you so much for coming and for sticking through this. Thank you. So we clearly have things to talk about, but go ahead.
So the picture for the cosmological fluctuations would be that there was a period of acceleration for early times, but due not to the driven not by the impulson, but by the Onstogod vacuum energy before it decays.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I have pieces of a picture and not a full cosmological model, and so I'm not. I'm not so bold as to throw out everything. But yeah, the idea would be that there is that whatever else is going on, and there may be other stuff going on, this mechanism should be there. And the vacuum energy should be treated in a dynamical way by coupling it through the scalar conformal on. And that one has to resolve that dynamics. And so one could have a cosmology which is spatially anisotropic, which is not globally FRW, not globally de Sitter, but would you have a space-time dependent vacuum energy, and therefore a dark energy that might still be visible today, in which case that's going to show up in large-scale structure if we have a complete description of it, and that this should give us a way out of the various cosmological problems. That's the grand hope, right? That's what I've been working for. But it's a picture still, and not a full theory.
And what needs to be light relative to what in order for the trace anomaly contribution to effective stress densities for the non-large scales?
Good. So it's essentially when this conformal behavior sets in. So near to the horizon, every mass is going to become irrelevant. Okay. So you expect this kind of behavior from the conformal anomaly near to the horizon, no matter what the mass of the matter fields are. This term is always there, and it's a question, when does it dominate the others? And of course,
because this business of all the solutions of this ever, that's why it dominates the
growth. Well, because kinematically you always have conformal invariance near the horizon, and so you look at any scalar or any massive field equation, you always get this behavior near to the horizon. If you go sufficiently close, how close depends on the mass of the field. And of course, we do have massless fields, so we have photons, nothing else, and so there will always be these conformal fluctuations taking place at the larger scales. It's not necessarily the full answer, but it's an attempt to get some leading term that can to identify the degree of freedom which is responsible for relaxation. And then more stuff has to be folded in on it. Yes?
I'm trying to get my head around what it's also said, because I mean, we knew the older story, people calculated back fractions of the solution they're diverging in IR, and then they turn ambient energy momentum tensor was diverging.
So which are you thinking of?
For example, Brandenburger lockup, right?
Those are loop calculations with matter fields.
Right. So yeah. Why would this, and the story at the end of the day was that it was engaging with them.
Well, I spent a lot of time talking about gauge invariant things, but we obviously have to talk about it with Neil some more. But this is a different effect. It's not. I'm not looking at loop calculations of interacting matter fields. I'm not sure exactly what you're thinking of.
At the end of the day, you see a solution which is divergent. The solution itself obviously doesn't necessarily mean any catastrophe. Even if we turn it back into the effective energy momentum tensor or something like that, that doesn't necessarily also mean physically something is going wrong. So we have to come up with some physical observable in order to really say something is not happening in there seems to be.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I think modulo our discussion, I think there are physical observables which do become large.
Yeah, but I think
and linear order, and it means you have to do better than linear order. But no one, to my knowledge, has looked at this effect. It's not what Brandenburger.
No,
it's not other people have talked of. You're asking in a very general way.
Yeah. Guarantee that in this case
okay, you want guarantees? I can't give you guarantees. I can only, but I need to look at exactly what you're thinking about and try to compare to so we can ask ask a sharp question. Yeah.
I can't decide what
okay. Yeah.
This discussion is about.
Yeah.
It's very similar to a discussion that has been going on for a while in the soft mode discussion. So
everything is soft modes, right?
okay.
All right.
So here, if you look at the V potential, at I call the Newtonian potential, it enters the delta GTT and GTI, which are usually the lamps and the shifts, that is, functions that we can use to whatever we want. So the question here is, well, if this is such functions, is there observables that really couple to the lamps and the shifts? And the thing is that the usual gauging observable that people consider do not. But that doesn't mean that they are not physical. That is, the observable you have to hook up So I think.
Yes, yeah, so I haven't looked at every possible observable. So you tell me what you want to look at, and we'll try to do it.
The functions of the local curvature, they would not see that guy. That's the statement.
Yeah, so, and look at correlation functions too.
But yeah. Well, this is where it gets interesting. The question is the same thing for the subways. That is there the new observables, like Wilson lines or things that connect directly to the physics of the background that you can cook up? That would be sensitive to these.
Okay.
But the usual ones that people consider gauging current are kind of immune to that object. So I think this is why there's this discussion, which can.
Well, I don't think it's quite enough. I mean, I think there are local things that you can compute, nobody says they give.
Lapse and shift.
No, this is not lapse and shift.
Okay, we can look at
this. This is not lapse and shift. These are the scalar, the scalar potentials.
Yeah, but okay. Anyway, look at your equation
that GPT. Yeah, but if anyone can tell me what else you want to calculate, I'd be very happy to try to do it. It's just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I may
be wrong about this, but I think it's a different question than what she's asking.
It's exactly the same.
Soft modes.
No, it's the same, in the sense that she's not talking
about... It's in a different language, but it's...
Yeah, it's a different language. It's the same discussion going on.
Okay.
The discussion is following. If you look, first decide what you call gauging and observable. If you have a restricted definition...
A linear order.
Well, it doesn't even matter, at all. It really doesn't matter. And let's say you have a restricted definition that you're only going to look at gauging and observable that are not anchored to a boundary or infinity or something like that, that is integral of the curvatures. Then the soft modes completely decouple this gauging current observable. So if you declare that physics can only be seen with that particular subset of observable, you are going to conclude, and that's the discussion, that these guys are unphysical. The resolution.
I wish you wouldn't point there. And maybe somebody else's modes are
this. Really, from what I see, would satisfy them. But what's interesting about them is that it doesn't mean that they're physical. What it means is that you restrict
It's too restrictive.
Physical observable which are not of that class. And if you consider them, these ones become physical. I think that's the tension. It's really about.
I mean, there is certainly confusion. I can certainly tell you. I've looked at a lot of those papers, and it's hard to come away with a very sharp and clear thing. People say various things.
It depends on what you call observable. It really depends on what you call observable. That's the whole point. That's why people could go back and forth for hundreds of years and never resolve that. Once you make it,
I'm going to say hundreds of
years. I hope not. I'm not going to live that long.
It's been going on for 6 years. Now that we have the resolution, you have to wait that they die. so that they kind of change the point of view.
All right. You tell me what you want to calculate, and we'll try to figure it out.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
I think that's the.